everyone. Welcome to episode 40 of the Passion Effect podcast. I'm your host, Jack Pittman. My guest is Joe Wiebe. He's a former co-director of a not-for-profit called From the Ground Up. He's a founder of Sydney Property Listings and Doohat Labs. He's also the co-founder of the Constant Student Community that allows creatives to explore entrepreneurial paths. Joe is the co-author of the best-selling book, 18 and Lost, written by Joe and eight of his friends to show that there's no perfect path after high school. After 3 years at university studying psychology and feeling lost to now writing books and creating online communities, Joe's story is proof that life is anything but linear. And today on the podcast, Joe is here to chat to us about his post-high school experiences and where he is today, how you can find your passions by applying the concept of a thousand doors and audience of none, and how you can live life on your own terms. Please join me in welcoming my guest today, Joe Wiebe. Joe, welcome to the Passion Effect. It's great to have you. Firstly, how are you going?
I'm very good, mate. It's a good time. We're coming to the end of the year and it's the rush, but it's all good rush. So great timing, I think.
Great to hear. I'm really excited about this conversation, and particularly because I know you've just released the book, as I was mentioning, 18 and Lost, and I've just finished reading it, and I think it's a really powerful story for young people to read. And I would highly recommend any young person who's in high school or just finished high school to read it. What people may or may not know about you, Joe, and this is something that I find very fascinating, is that you describe yourself as a doorman. People might have all sorts of images right now when they hear that term of someone, a salesperson going to the door or a postman, but could you describe to us what you really mean when you call yourself a doorman and how that kind of led you to where you are today?
I did spend a lot of time working in real estate. So in one sense, I'm that kind of doorman. It's basically the concept of opening doors for others is how you actually get anywhere. So I write a lot about this concept you alluded to at the start called the thousand doors, about how if you are any situation you're in life, you're actually just in one room, kind of like being on a level of a game. And you've always got these options for where you can go. But we often forget as human beings that behind each door or each option is another level or another room with more doors there and so on. And it keeps going. So it's not just the next opportunity, but where that will continue to lead you. And most people, and I say thousand because you think about it, that keeps linking. That's a whole journey, like up to a thousand doors perhaps. And a lot of people turn down that whole journey because they look at the first door and think, I don't know if I want to go in there, but they don't think ahead. And the idea I realized through my own experience is that the way you actually get that journey happening for you and really get the doors you want opened is to actually forget about yourself for a bit and focus on those around you, the people you meet, and how you can bring something that's good for them and bring them that door. And then they can go through and then they can unlock something for you.
So in a way, being a doorman is really a metaphor for you've got all these options in front of you and you have a choice about which option you pursue, and then being able to show those opportunities to others so that they can go through the doors and have greater opportunities as well.
Absolutely.
And how would you describe yourself? Like, who is Joe Wiebe?
Well, Joe Wiebe, this is deep, but I think of myself in that doorman way because I don't find any job title really summarizes who I am. The thing with the book, 18 and Lost, and the stories in that book. So there's a whole bunch of, I'm one of the stories that gets told in there about life after high school. We had Jordan, Marvin, Gabby, Tyler. We had a bunch of people. One of the things they have in common, which is common with everyone I've talked to, is that no one really ends up doing what they thought they'd do. You can't see it coming. So I don't feel like there's one magical thing that everyone is meant to do with their life. A lot of people have a big calling, like Tiger Woods was a golfer from a young age. But normally that's because they come into that sort of identity early, but you're always more than one thing anyway. Tiger Woods is a bit of a figure and an entrepreneur. So me too. I do business stuff. I do writing. I do artistic things. I'm an amateur at a whole bunch of things that will never make it onto a LinkedIn profile. And so I feel like the time we're living in now, we need to move past defining people by job titles. And the first question you ask people being, what do you do? Because I think we're all multi-interested, multi-passionate people. And I just don't think that we're in a society in the last couple of maybe decades or centuries that acknowledges that.
I think you're right there. We tend to cling on to identities we hold about ourselves, and sometimes that can make us feel a bit stuck or feeling like we need to do more with our lives instead of pursuing that thing that maybe we're really interested in. And speaking of pursuing things we're really interested in, why don't you talk to us about your experience after high school and being at university? Because it was certainly quite an interesting journey for you that was certainly not linear in any way by the sounds of it.
No, and linear is that whole idea of straight line. So the opposite of the thousand doors, which is that you can see everything in advance. It's just this train track you're just following, which is the trap I think a lot of people fall into and miss out on the exciting parts of life. And that was the case for me. I left school wanting to be a filmmaker. So all those other things you listed about me, they weren't on my mind back when I was 18. But I was pretty scared about film because it seemed very unsafe to follow that. And I was very much not sure of myself and worried about kind of falling behind. So because I had a really good mark after high school, I thought I should use that. I felt a lot of pressure to use that to do a university pathway. And I thought that would be a good plan B or safe kind of backup. And because of that, I went into university probably with a very half-assed kind of attitude. I didn't really make the most of it, wasn't there to make the most out of it. Ended up being an experience I call 3 dead years. Like I felt like I wasn't going anywhere. I was just coming in, do the odd psychology lecture, and then go. I didn't really meet people. I didn't really challenge myself in any particular way. And the whole time just felt flat. And it wasn't so bad. It wasn't like there was just any terrible single thing happening. So it's really hard to articulate it to people. It was hard to talk about. But I definitely felt, a bit aimless and lost, if you will, and not really alight with that feeling of passion. And after that, things changed. I was meant to do an honors year in psychology, is the fourth and pivotal year. I got accepted into it, which was great. A lot of hard work went into that. And then I got rejected from it a couple of weeks later, which was me waving angry fists at the university. There was like an admin error. So bit frustrating, but turned out to be a blessing. It was a door. It was non-linear, as you said. And it was basically my friend started this nonprofit in Nepal and came back to Australia at the same time that this uni mix-up happened. And so I had this time on my hands. And so I opened up something new and he said, help me run this thing. And then that's kind of led me to now my biggest focus is education and entrepreneurial stuff professionally, because it was an actual education pathway to that, trying to work on stuff in Nepal, understanding that power of business and entrepreneurship is a great way to enable people in different parts of the world, and that we need to help people learn how to do those things better. So that's kind of been my journey to where I am now. Yeah. And wanting to do the book and things like that.
It certainly seems there that storytelling was a big part of, I guess, your identity, not only in your business, but also in, you know, your early interest in film. And I guess that's something I guess I'm curious about is, where was that early passion and desire for film whilst you were at university? Did you pursue film when you were doing university? How did that all happen?
I did one or two courses. So at NIDA, an acting school, and also one at AFTERS, a film, television, radio school, and both in Sydney, reputable places for the film industry. And then I had made maybe one short film, I think. So I was kind of had this itch to do it, but I was incredibly scared of making work that wasn't going to be good enough, because I was scared of putting something bad out there. And then if it was bad, it would mean that shit, I'm not actually going to be a great filmmaker. But this has been my dream for so long. It's been built up in my mind like a fantasy, like a bubble. And I was also scared to pop that bubble. I was trying to find a way through making this career happen somehow without getting my hands dirty and feeling like but when I look back now, you really have to start terribly, fail fast and learn fast. That's really how you get anywhere. When you're afraid of putting something out that's not good, I'm sure this the later podcast episodes you've done, Jack, are better than maybe the first one, or maybe not. But you know, it's hard not to get better if you persist. I was just too scared to do that, so I did half things. Eventually, I plucked up the courage or the motivation to go do a little course. It was just too slow, and I didn't really build up the momentum momentum is very powerful and you don't build up the momentum, it's tricky.
I relate to that idea of fear because I remember when I was starting the podcast, as someone who didn't post much online, it was very scary to put yourself out there, put a full form interview on the internet. But you're right, it does take courage and you need to overcome that fear, but it's certainly not an easy thing. So do you have any advice for people as to how they just overcome that fear and start achieving the things they want to? Do they need to find a tribe of people to support them? Where should they start?
There's a couple of things there. When you go to the gym, you don't start off lifting 100 kilograms. When I launched my podcast last year, I wasn't nervous. Right, you were, but I had been posting stuff online for years by that point. So you got to build up to it and just break it down into smaller steps is normally easier. So in the gym, you can lift 300 kilos maybe eventually or 100, but you might not start there. You might need to start at one. Others might need to start at 30. And that's just the reality. So breaking down things into smaller steps and then building up is one thing that really works with fear. Because fear is all about adjusting to a new situation. Fear is normally down to something not being familiar rather than it being objectively scary. For example, everyone's afraid of public speaking. Not many people are scared of driving. Which one's more dangerous? So your fear is not proportionate to the actual activity. It's just based on what's familiar and where you think you're sticking yourself out there. Nothing really bad happens when you put an interview online, but it's still scary, even if I explain that to you. And the other thing you said makes a huge difference. Having a tribe of people, right? You acknowledge at the start, we're big on online communities and obviously in-person communities too. When you're in a group of people or an environment where other people are doing their own things, they're following their passions, if you will, they're making podcasts, they're writing books, they're making startups, or they're taking risks at work, maybe even less radical creator economy stuff, it just makes it easier for you to do it too because they support you. So one or two people doing the sort of things that you're vaguely interested in is gold. That's all you need.
And it seems like experience is one of the best teachers in life.
Experience is probably the only real teacher in life. Whenever I explain a concept to you or someone else or someone's listening to an idea on your podcast, they go through this process where they start filtering that back and trying to relate that to the experiences they've had, memories, things they've read. You're always just trying to encode new information and learnings based on prior knowledge, prior experience. There's people who stay, PTSD is learning based on past experience, like loud noises are dangerous. It's an association from the past. It's hard to unlearn. Leonardo da Vinci was big on that idea, by the way. He didn't get a formal education. And so he always detested the people who just wanted to, reading's great, right? But people just want to sit there, read books and be like super smart. He used to go run his own experiments and then read books to kind of support and multiply the learning he got from experiences. So at some point you have to go and get experience. Doing a podcast like you're doing is one of the things I encourage so many young people to do. Because you can attract things towards you, but also you're getting real experience. Like you're not reading about interviewing and public speaking. You're doing it. And the longer you persist with it, I assume the better you'll get up to a threshold. And then you have to be more deliberate and specific about getting better. Once you just get to a really passable kind of proficiency, that's how the whole thing kind of works. So experience, big, big fan.
And you touched on earlier, and we talked about it, about the idea of the 1,000 doors and having the courage to take advantage of new opportunities when they come to you. And it seems like that in itself is a form of new experiences and learning and overcoming fear, because it's not easy to walk through the doors. And that's why it's good to support other people, as you said, to walk through those doors.
100% is. Now I look back, I have the unique perspective and advantage from those prior experiences, because I've done the nonprofit thing, I've done the real estate thing. There's not many people who've done that combination. It's like one experience was about international development, different cultures, and different political environments. The other is about like a lot of stuff to do with property, investing, understanding the specifics of running a business. So they give a fantastic, interesting combination, like a problem-solving toolkit for me. Also, I've had the experience of, oh, I did that. That was kind of a bit out there, made it through. Then I've done the real estate thing. Oh, I've done that, kind of survived that. That was difficult. All right. So, oh, wow. I guess if I go take on something I have no experience in, I'll probably just figure it out too. And you, like you said, if there is fear, yes, but you build momentum as you go. Like you break down that idea that you can't go do new things, that you need to be qualified to do everything you got to do in life. And you can just really chip away by putting those experiences and kind of convince. It's very powerful to just get that momentum going, and really you have to watch yourself do specific things, not just observe others doing it. So it's, yeah.
And to your point, it's a probability game, isn't it? I mean, the more opportunities that you take advantage of, the more likely that one of them is going to stick. You know, I mean, if you apply for 50, 60 jobs, you would hope that one of them will respond back to you. I mean, it's a numbers game.
It absolutely is. James Dyson, like the Dyson vacuum cleaners, he had 5,217 prototypes, I think, of the first kind of breakthrough different type of vacuum cleaner they made. You know, Thomas Edison, 10,000 versions of the light bulb,
sure,
they say. The best lawyer I know is 74 years old now. He applied for 400 jobs, he said, when he was getting, got rejected, you know, up to 400 or 399 times. The rejection is not an indication of how good you are. Einstein, I was just writing about today, struggled to get jobs as an academic and a high school teacher while he's developing theory of relativity and all this stuff. So it's not just that simple that you get rejected, you're not good enough to, like, it's just part of the process. And you got to fire those shots. Small effort, you might lose every time, but if you do win, what does win big? Like, what would be like, wow, if I won that? So that job, being able to have a business, insert whatever you value. But yeah, you got to fire shots.
It's that ROI, isn't it, on experiences? I know that's something you talk a lot about. What do you mean by that?
ROI, short for like return on investment. So I can put $10 in property A and I might get, well, it'd be more than $10, but for argument's sake, I get back $5. If I put $10 in property B and get back $10, then property B has a bigger ROI. So for what I'm putting in, I'm getting more back. And you can apply that way of thinking, which is a very like investment way of thinking. You can apply that to anything. I encourage people to think about it when they think about learning, because a lot of young people like you and I, I'm calling myself young. One of our biggest priorities is wanting to learn. All right. So you want to like learn the most you can. So where are you going to get, for the same amount of time and money that you could put into whatever courses, uni, learning on the job, whatever, interesting question to ask is where I'm actually going to get the most learning for that time. I use the example of I'm going to watch a movie Saturday night. Would I rather watch a 7 out of 10 movie or a 10 out of 10 movie? Like the 7 out of 10 is still enjoyable. It's still great. But if there's a 10 out of 10 movie, I can spend the same amount of time, but actually get a better experience. And so that's a framework I apply to, yeah, just about everything. It's like, even for me, it's become a bit ridiculous. Like if I go buy a phone or a tablet or something like that, it's like, how much value is this really going to bring to my life? Like, do I really want to spend this much money on that when that's X amount of whatever, coffees help me concentrate or whatever. So you can get carried away, but it is very interesting to think about and weigh up opportunities. I think what are the doors behind this? Yeah. What else comes from this?
Do you think those experiences, if we just take it back to your university experiences, even though they were a 6 out of 10 for you and not quite that 10 out of 10 that you were hoping for, do you think that those experiences have a role, even though they may not feel as significant, do you feel like they have a role in maybe helping you get to where you were? Because if you chose a different door, who knows where you'd be now?
You can't ever know when something bad happens, if it's actually bad or not. You only see a short-term story. And the thing is that you rightly point out, it's a story. And the story always has, whether it's Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, or any other Netflix show now, the story always has a lull. It always has conflict. It always has difficulty. So it probably wasn't the best thing I could have done for myself if I was really passionate, interested in film already. And I was already very clear that that's what I was passionate in. So yes, at the time, probably not like if someone in the same situation probably would advise, you know, go do film first. You can always go to uni later. But looking back for my story, I can't change my story. You know, all I can do is maximize the value of that experience. So if it was a 6 out of 10, instead of sitting around thinking, well, this is just what I got to put up with, or how bad's the system, I can actually use that experience to build what I care about doing and fuel me, and use the story of it in the book 18 and Lost to help other people, and motivation now to not waste opportunities and to make the most of things. So it's this trick of when something bad happens to you, don't sit there like thinking, I would have been better off if I didn't do this.
Default.
Flip it around. Make it the best thing that could have happened because of how you've responded. And that's, I try the best to be a personal example of that in my own life with that uni experience, which is where all the education work we're doing now. Would I care about it as much if I hadn't had that experience? It'd be hard to say I would. Yeah, it's interesting.
And it's easier said than done, isn't it? Of course, to turn a negative situation into a positive situation. But what do you think is important in terms of viewing situations more positively, in terms of finding your passions and things like that?
One of the first words that comes to my mind is practice.
What do you mean by that?
I think that you got to practice applying that mindset to things, like coming back to the gym analogy. Like I don't know if people listening would admit they're a negative person, but if you find you're very negative in the thoughts you have when bad things happen, it's probably a big shift to just tomorrow go, oh, that guy that Jack interviewed, he said be positive. So I'm just going to be positive forever. Nothing's ever going to bother me. And then things just, you encode things as being bad again. But if you stick with it, you keep, and that's why I think podcasts, books, and all this are great. A lot of the time I used to find that reading and listening to stuff would just interrupt the way I was thinking and give me a different way of thinking. So every week it was like, there was always a different perspective coming from someone having a conversation like this that could just pierce through and make me think, I got to change the way I'm thinking about that. And I think over time you get better and better at responding positively, because we are human beings, our reactions, they're kind of automatic, right? Like if something darts across my eyes, I'll react. So you can't just speak English to yourself saying change that reaction straight away, but you can condition reactions, right? Conditioning, which is like the long-term training, basically. Like when you, again, the gym thing, like you are conditioning your muscles when you work out. You are slowly,
true,
when you're doing your podcast thing, you're not consciously, when you're interviewing me, you're not consciously remembering the 500 things you've learned by doing the Passion Effect and ticking them off necessarily. It's become somewhat automatic, right? The way you would ask a question, prepare and all that, it's become almost automatic. It's been conditioned. And that's the level that things become kind of automatic. So the mindset aspect of you is something that you can condition. It's not something you can change with necessarily a flick of a switch. So I'd just say practice thinking positively about things and stick with it and keep listening to the Passion Effect.
Talk there about the idea of importance of practice and reinforcing habits. I think social media, as we've seen, is a bit of an indicator of that. When you consume social media, there's been studies, increase in anxiety and whatnot. That's a really interesting topic to talk about as well.
Social media is one of the things that is conditioning you. Let me make that clear and I'll restate it. Social media is one of the things that's conditioning you. Everything you're regularly interacting with is shaping you in some way, shape, or form. One of the things I did in January of this year is I took all the social media apps off my phone. I was watching this YouTube clip of a guy called Chamath. He's a very well-known kind of social impact investor guy. A lot of great YouTube videos. And he's just talking about don't wire your brain for short-term thinking. Your social media is one of those things that is wiring you to be reactive. The whole thing works on dopamine.
Instant gratification.
instant gratification, very good. Like the red colors of the alerts, like it's always red, right? They know what they're doing, because that's the color that really triggers you and wiring you to expect a reward, like a kid that's gotten used to getting treats whenever they do their homework. Like you just, all right,
Pavlov's dog,
photo up, where's the likes? And so it's wiring you to seek short-term rewards. Because that's why if you want to think long-term, because he's talking to like investors and business people, you need to think long-term, like it's never going to be that short and quick. You got to think about what's coming and rewards down the line. And you need to be conditioning your mind for the opposite. You need to be thinking long-term and being able to be patient for things, not like feel good right now by getting a quick fix. So it is a force to be managed. I can't get away from some of the benefits it has, of course, which I get to meet a lot of like great people through the magic of social media. So I can't just sit here and bag it. There are advantages. So I mitigate its effects on me by mitigate, meaning I manage, which is I just check it on the computer, which I don't find desktop, which I find is not nearly as addictive. And I really encourage that because it's not like the cold turkey quit. You're not socially excluded. But it is like it's a safe buffer and it gives you some sort of restraint. But yeah, it can be very dangerous because you will feel the impact of social. You will feel it very slowly, a creeping effect. It just forces you to compare yourself to other people more often, more than humans are designed to do, I think.
I think as well, to your point, there is potentially an upside to this, which is, you know, being able to connect with communities like the Constant Student and take your education to another level. But, and then, as you said, even changing the media that you're consuming, so that's more positive and rewiring your brain for more positive thinking.
Yeah. Like we started the Constant Student, as you mentioned, like an online community. And what that basically is, the way I describe it, it's like, imagine just a cool village you lived in. If you lived in a cool village where everyone wants to get the most out of life. Everyone really wants to learn. Like there's not one thing they even want to learn, but they just love learning and they always want to progress to something new. And it's the thousand doors. It's not, there's not one goal that makes your whole life worth living. It's there's always a new door to open. So you imagine like living in a whole village, you know, in a group like that, except it's online, right? It starts online. Now in that place, you probably spend less time looking at maybe Instagram or anything like that, because there's probably people are sharing the stuff that they write and the podcast they make. And you're way more interested in stuff made in an environment like that, your cool village, than you're interested in like what the rest of the noisy world might be saying all the time. So like when people are like on an online community, we don't have it. It's not run on Facebook groups or anything like that. But imagine if we essentially we have our own Facebook group kind of like format, not on Facebook, so not distracted by Facebook, where you go in there and you can still get like interaction with people, see stimulating material people share, put on calls that you can come to and workshops and stuff you can learn, connect with people, and it might just be more specific to you. So it's interesting if people listening to this think about the concept of online communities that are maybe not living on social media sites. They might find them through social media sites, but it's a rising movement. It's a new kind of type of business model, and it's a rising movement, and it will be, there'll be things that will be very specific to either what you're interested in or where you live. So I found one yesterday called Early Work. It's probably pretty cool for the sort of people listening to The Passion Effect. And it's, you know, a lot of people who are early in their careers and also kind of interested in startup world. And it's Australian and they have a different thread. If you're in Sydney, you can go on that thread. And then a lot of those people are meeting there and then catching up to meet in life, which is something that happens a bit in Constant Student too, in the one we run, but as just one, it's a really cool and maybe different way of hanging out online for a higher quality kind of experience. It's actually a bit more positive conditioning rather than, yeah, because Instagram's just whoever putting up whatever photos about stuff. I don't really care. Like I don't really scroll on Instagram. I just check my messages. Whereas those are the online interactions people can have that are probably way more productive and stimulating and make you feel more positive. So very exciting time, I think, online.
Bringing it back to what we were talking earlier about tribes and finding a tribe, I think finding your passions and finding those people who are not only like similar to you, but also even like above you, can like push you to be better. I think it was Dale Carnegie who said, yeah, you know, you're influenced by the closest five people around you.
Yeah, it's very true. And I find that I still have all the same friends I did before maybe my interests became a bit more entrepreneurial in nature, which then I meet more people who, more and more people I know now have their own podcasts and things like that as time goes on. And what I just find is that I'm, without being conscious about it, I'm not even trying to like hang out more with them than them. I'm just subconsciously spending more time with people who are going in the same direction I'm going in. It's just very natural. It is incredibly powerful though. I have a blog post on my website called Find Your Scotts. And Scott is also one of the authors of, pardon me, 18 and Lost. He's chapter one. He's a high school friend of mine. We went to the same high school as you, Jack. And we ended up, funnily enough, working together on this Nepal thing once he saw what I was doing, and then co-founding the Constant Student together and doing the book together. We've been on that same journey. We're incredibly like-minded. And the people and the things he's introduced me to is just one example of, you know, one of the five people I hang out with most. It's just been incredible. I mean, the book wouldn't happen without him. The Constant Student wouldn't happen without him. They're the things I'm doing with my life right now. They're my main focus. I've met a lot of great people, like other authors of the book. I wouldn't have met them too. So I'm doing some work with Byron Dempsey of Driven Young, who again would, you know, resonates thematically with what you're doing, Jack, and all these other people and friends and some of the closest people now. And you just, it's the thousand doors thing. Like more than anything you're going to learn in a lecture or on a YouTube video or a podcast, it's the people that are going to make the biggest difference. The people in your life are going to make the biggest difference, the quality of doors you get in your life more than anything else. Because even, all right, I have a podcast, you have a podcast, all these things are fantastic. But no one on a podcast is going to like go single you out as you're just one listener, single you out and tell you what you specifically can do and who you should go talk to and make an introduction. And that is a thing that happens in relationships. That's why I'm so passionate about communities as like the future of education, because rather than what information you need to hear, I think the focus, the priority is what people do you need to find. Mm-hmm. People slightly ahead of you is great. People way ahead of you is also great. And people going through the same stage as you is the experience. It's Harry Potter. It's like, where's Harry without Ron and Hermione? Because those people will help you find great podcasts too. They'll recommend you great books. Did you hear about this? What's this crypto thing or whatever? Have you heard about this? That's what happens when people are mishmashed together. So I think, Kanye, I know you want to talk about how do you actually get there? Right? How do you actually find those people? And I think you have to really listen to what you're interested in, or if you're at the stage already passionate about. To me, passion is that feeling you can't fake about something that you love. It's this feeling that ensues. So you kind of stumble into it for me. That's my belief. And when you actually pursue it, that's when you find those people. So for me, I didn't find those people in film because I was hardly doing anything in film. But when I went to the course, I did the course, the one course I did, that's where I found a couple of people to help me do a short film. Otherwise, I didn't know who to ask to help. So that is the real power of those people in your life. And also, I think that is the best way to find them is lean in and do things. And I think, I also think be discoverable. Like, again, this is why like everyone should probably have a podcast. Everyone should do essentially what you've done, Jack, at a young age. It's never too early. It's the best time because you're showing that you're interested in things when you do this. Even if you never get like a million downloads or anything, you're showing that you're like, you're open, you're experiencing things, and people can, like someone like me can see you and go, all right, we're doing another book now. So who are the people that are most likely to kind of do 810 and Lost Volume 2? All right. So someone who's not doing it, who's not advertising them, like not advertising, but who's not discoverable, who's not going and showing other people what they're interested in by just doing it. People like me won't think about them for opportunities. But when you're young, people love enthusiastic, interested young people. They just can't see you most of the time. So you got to be, yeah, visible. And then things, if you're not visible, if you're hiding in your house, I guess as the metaphor is, people can't see you on the street. kind of thing. But if you're showing what you're doing, whether it's sharing it online or whatever format, or going to events or whatever you can do for your passion area or interest area, then things can, and you'd be amazed at the things that would find you too.
And I want to take it back to the idea of passions, because I know you talk a lot about the idea of audience of none. Could you explain what that concept is to our listeners and how it's impacted you?
Yeah, the audience of none is one of my favorite questions. I just devised to try and help people figure out what they're internally interested in. Simple question. What is something you do for an audience of none, where the only applause you'd listen out for in the end is your own? It's the idea of performing, doing something in front of an empty theater with no one watching you. So no one can applaud, no one's paying you, no one's showing up paying tickets. And the question is, what would you do, whether it's a hobby, a job for work, or any use of your time, that you'd happily do anyway if no one's watching? So for me, the biggest answer is writing. When we wrote 18 and Lost and the book I was writing before that about charity, I haven't released yet. I remember both books, I was thinking the whole time, I don't care if anyone never reads this, because I just enjoyed doing it so much. Like, the process of writing is something I'm in love with. I'm infatuated by, and it puts me in that flow state as well. That state of deep concentration where you lose track of time. Probably what a lot of people might feel, I don't know, gaming or something like that. And that question's powerful, because a lot of the reasons we do things in a culture where we're inundated with social media and the values of other people are for external reasons, for image, for status. So we look like we're successful. So we feel like we're doing something with our lives. Whereas the audience of none is a thought experiment that just strips that away. So you can think about what are you internally interested in? Because intrinsic drives are always more sustainable. Think about it. If the reason for doing something comes from you, I enjoy writing, for example, I know that I'll never have a problem writing and performing at writing, because I'm in love with it. I'm playing. As Naval Ravikant says, you can't compete with someone who's playing when you're working, when you're doing it for money and they're just doing it because they love doing it. But yeah, extrinsic things are like, you need to be paid to do it, to want to do it. Or yeah, you only do it if people validate you. You know, if they say, Jack, you're so good. So praise and compliments, actually, for me, extrinsic, external. Like, I don't need to be praised for writing. I just like doing it anyway. If you are looking for praise and approval, like winning gold medal or Academy Award or something like that, then you're still actually playing to other people. You're still actually doing it mainly so they love you, which is, I think, an example from sports, probably like what Diego Maradona, I think, opened up about a couple of times. Like, he needed the love of people. That's what he kind of got out of being a famous footballer. So it's a very, yeah, it's had a major impact on me, because it helps me make decisions. Also helps me help people. Because when they're like, I don't know what I want to do, and all this stuff everyone always complains about with their life, I don't know what I want to do with my life, I go, what would you do for an audience of none? And they go, ah, oh, well, you know, it's, and then they say something like, yeah, music or whatever. I'm like, all right, well, why aren't you doing it? Why aren't you spending as much time possible on doing it? I can't get paid for that. All right, we'll get paid for something else for as long as you want, but maximize the time you get doing what you do for an audience of none. And then if there's a way eventually to build that into a sustainable career or income, then do that. Start with there. It'll change. There might be more than one thing. So I found it incredibly powerful, and it's always great for self-reflection. Like, would I do this for an audience of none? Because then you know that you'll probably will follow through very well.
And to your point, it doesn't necessarily mean forgoing your true passions at the time. It just means, you know, yes, have that backup plan that might keep you financially going, but, you know, don't be afraid to invest your time into the things you love. And as you said, do for an audience of none.
Yeah, I think you might, like, not even the, I think the term backup plan is almost for something that I'm going to do that in case. So it's almost like just what keeps you going, what sustains you so you can invest as much. I love the idea of, like you said, of investing time. Right? Like, so you can invest as much time into that as possible. Because when you look back on your life, yes, money is a thing. When we're looking forward, we think, where's money coming from in the future? Will I have enough to do X and Y? But when people look back on their lives, they normally think about the memories, and you measure it in memories. So you can invest your time now in things that are going to turn into like great memories and experiences. So you'll be wealthy in the right way, all the way through. And then you just need to make it sustainable and financially, commercially smart about doing that. To the end, then that's a very individual. Some people, Leonardo da Vinci, if I can use him as an example, he hated that he just never did anything for money. He was very reckless. So because of that, he wasn't always that. He had to go find the next patron or the next job to get him by. He just loved doing things for pure curiosity. And he kept the Mona Lisa in his apartment for 17 years and stuff like that, 14 years or something. He just would bring people up to show them, like the Mona Lisa, the most famous painting, I think, of all time. He just did things for an audience of none. He really didn't care. So you can choose how, you don't have to do what everyone else is doing, right? You can choose how reckless you want to be about it, but you just have to deal with the consequences, I guess.
Yeah, and as you said there, it's, you know, there's possibility of an upside, you know, investing time into something you're really passionate about, because that might, in the long run, if we talk about like what we were talking earlier about looking at the long run, you might actually end up being more financially successful if that's what you care about.
So very likely. Who would you rather hire, a passionate person or someone who's going to be paid to do everything you need them to do in a role?
Probably, right? Passionate,
like,
person.
You can't fake that. You can't fake like genuine passion and interest in something. And what I've found is that the people I do work with, and I, if I'm responsible for like paying them, team members and whatnot, I found that what really is the magic formula is you find people who would do their job for free. Like they just like doing what they're doing in that role. But then obviously you pay them so that they can do it full time and they have enough money to whatever, pay their bills or look after their family. Because what I get out of those people is I don't actually have to manage them in a traditional way. Like I don't have to like, come on, Jack, you know, work hard this quarter and I'll give you a bonus or anything. Because they need not motivation. They are their motivation. That's a dream when you're working with people. So that's the way I think about it. It's not like our workforce doesn't operate that way. But if I were, you know, premier for a day or something, or prime minister for a day, or I go, you're only allowed to put someone in a role if they pass the audience of none test, and we'd have a very effective economy.
So it's an interesting way that we circle back to the idea of audience of none. But as we can see, it's pretty obvious that the idea of the audience of none is pretty valuable when it comes to finding our passions. And I hope the listeners found that fascinating as well, because I want to talk about the book now, 18 and Lost. Talk to me, what is the book about? I know we've already sort of touched on it. And how did the book come together? Because let's be honest, getting eight people and convincing eight people to write a book together is probably, you know, something that takes a lot of courage to do, you know, to get that many people willing to write a book together. So yeah, talk to me about the whole process.
I've done crazier things, I think, but maybe that haven't reached the light of day. This was just a desire to get people realizing what they could do was the initial focus. I was actually mainly focused on the authors we're working with rather than, say, necessarily the readers of the book. My journey and experiences, we talked about experience before, I did this crazy, I was co-director of a nonprofit in Nepal, which was not something I was expecting to do at the age of 21 or whatever. Then I started a real estate company with like no experience at the age of 22 with business partners who left me and I was on my own. I've had some very interesting experiences, but I realized that I've just learned so much by going into the deep end, by doing the unusual doors. And so we were thinking about, Scott and I, how do we make that a reality for other people? Because it's kind of random, nonlinear opportunities. So how do you bring that into like an education system? So we started the idea of like making group collaborative projects that people are not as intimidated to do, and they don't have to go maybe as out of their way as like deciding to write a book. If you can bring them together and they just write a chapter each, you can just show, hey, you can become an author in a month. And then you send a message to them, but also anyone who hears about the book, that anyone can kind of do kind of anything. That was our goal. So we're like, we're going to run a retreat. And we just invited them to this retreat. And they kind of knew there was this book. A lot of them like didn't read my invitations. They didn't even know there was a book. They're just like, oh, come to this retreat. I'm like, yeah, we're writing a book together about like the journey after high school, and like what advice you'd give your younger self. And they actually, so we spent this time together getting to know each other and doing some self-awareness stuff at this retreat. And then we, on the last day, finally started talking about this book we're going to do. And they even had ideas about, no, we're not going to interview other people. Why don't we just tell our own stories? That'd be way better. That's what young people want to hear. So Scott and I, like, it was meant to be, you know, we were the leaders of the project. We're like, that sounds great. Why not? You got like collaboration and teamwork. You got to be open to ideas. You can't just be rigid and a dictator. So we're super open to that. Sounded better. So that's what we decided to do. And I gave everyone like a 5-week deadline. I was like, you got to write your chapter within 5 weeks. And they're all like, but no one wants to hear our stories. And I'm not a writer, and all this usual excuses people give me. I go, well, that's wrong. And you're going to do it anyway. And they did it. And the ones that complained about that the most wrote the best chapters, funnily enough. So, I've had so much positive feedback that which is remarkable. And I can't emphasize that these are everyday people. These are not accomplished, reputable writers beforehand or superstar millionaires or anything like that. They're just young people. Gabby was 18. Marvin, who's an absolute wrecking ball of a human being, you know, he's my age too. He hadn't written a book before. Jordan, that runs kite surfing now. We've just got such a diverse spread of people, and they just tell their stories. Like it's super simple, because there's no one perfect way. There is no secret. Like there's no way to kind of do life after high school right. There's just making the most honest and authentic decisions you can make. So yeah, we self-published the book. It took a bit longer than 5 weeks in the end, but we just showed that you can be an author. Like you can go, it doesn't cost me anything to put a book up on Amazon and sell it, start putting it for sale. It doesn't cost anything. People have no idea about that. Like the barrier to entry to creativity has never been lower. For any kind of creative online thing you want to do. So we're just doing our best to spread the awareness of that and hopefully connect with as many young people as possible.
What I really want to know is, what did your friends who were initially a bit skeptical at the start, what did they learn going through that experience of writing their own chapter?
They learn a lot about themselves. It's a big thing. So writing your own story is an incredible reflection experience, which might sound a bit cheesy, but reflection for me is how you maximize the learning you get from an experience. Like we've had this podcast episode now. We've done the interview. It's happened. Now I could spend 15 minutes after this though, writing down what did we talk about in this conversation and what did I learn from this conversation. And I would just get more learning out of it than I did if I just left it. So writing your own story, that's one thing they all got out of it. They learned more about the writing process. And I think they got a lot of self-belief. Tyler, chapter 3, landed a paid media, like a one-off media article with Mamma Mia after it, which is kind of exciting and random. And it's given her the confidence to go, she's got an idea for 2 other books now that she wants to work on. Got confidence as a writer. Josh Hodge, you know, is kind of like wanting to mix up his lifestyle from being a 9-to-5 worker and start doing his own projects. And the book gave him a lot of confidence. Now I'm trying to help him. He's launching his own startup in the co-working space, co-working industry. It's so much more than just like getting through and having a book out there. People don't necessarily see those doors when they're looking at an opportunity. So I even had people pull out, to be honest. Who, I don't know, becoming an author wasn't compelling enough for them, or just wasn't the right timing. Mm. We learned so much. I learned so much, and
we didn't charge anyone anything
to really. We paid for Airbnbs that we used to run the retreat, and so you compare that to say a traditional degree or schooling, like in a way shorter period of time, for fraction of the cost, absolute fraction of the cost, like the amount of learning you can get when you actually take the responsibility to do your own projects, is always going to like be the best learning experience. And you can do it really fast. Like the whole book was like maybe a year long process overall, but not for the authors. That was me organizing, editing and stuff. That mainly for them was 2 months worth of work. And we made it to Amazon bestsellers briefly. And we got an endorsement from like Seth Godin, who is like a very reputable person in education and marketing world and entrepreneurship. So it's incredible where you can go when you just do things. You just do cool things that appeal to you and seem, yeah. So there's a lot of power, I think, behind these experiences.
It's like that whole yes sir mantra of seeking discomfort. And it kind of links to our bit we talked about earlier about going through that door, having the courage to try new things. You never know what's on the other side.
Yeah, exactly. And something that's not natural to people, because they're used to people, human beings are wired for certainty, which certainty is safety in a lot of people's minds. Certainty is I know what's coming. I know that if I do this for a couple of years, then I can get a job paying that much and then I can get promoted and everything like that. A lot of people, you don't really have certainty though. You have the feeling of certainty because you don't know how things will go. You don't know how many people I meet finish their degrees. I'm 27. So I'm right in that age demographic of people who've just finished their degrees recently. And now they're like, ah, this is what I wanted to do. They just had this expectation. They never really tested and tried things. But then once you test and try things, new things pop up. The story I tell is of Christopher Columbus, who left Spain sailing west to try and get to Asia, which is obviously east of Spain. He's trying to go around all the conflict and power in Europe to get to Asia. And because he's going west, discovers America, the Americas. And so he obviously didn't know the Americas were there, because how can you know ahead of time what you'll discover, right? You have to set off on a journey. You will never do it again, staying home. But once you go on the journey, that's when you find new things. So that's the example I used to set off the understanding of the thousand doors, because once you open the next door, you're going to learn things in that room, but you can't learn it while you're here. You can't see that room yet. So you don't really know what you're going to want after you see what's in there. It's like, imagine this room is a restaurant, right? Pizza restaurant. You're like, I love pizza. This is where I'm going to stay till I die. Okay. But what's the cost of going to that room there? It doesn't take much. You're just going to go check it out. And then you go to that room. It's like, oh, there's dessert here. This is great. This is the room to be in. And then you're like, oh, but what's that door there? And you maybe just open it. I'm like, oh, this is blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Protein shake shop. I don't know. And then you get to this point. So if you do that enough times, which is the place I'm in now, you realize that, it will never stop. There will always be something exciting new to discover. But it can't be a discovery if you already know about it. It's the paradox. One of my dearest friends who's 74, I talked about him before, the lawyer. He goes, at the age of 62, I stepped down from being partner at a law firm, which consumed the majority of 40 something years of his life. Or he goes, then I thought I was a lawyer, and then I realized I was actually a teacher at the age of 62. And then 7 years later, after traveling the world teaching and everything, he started meeting all these young people who were trying to do all this change in the world. And he realized, I'm not just a teacher. I'm a mentor to people like this. This is my calling at the age of 69. So it doesn't stop. It doesn't end. You're not finding something you're going to do in your life. You are, I will insist till the cows come home, a multi-passionate human being. You are not one thing. You have no constraints on you other than the others you accept. And if people at the age of 62 realize a new calling after thinking they've found it, then you probably will too, as long as you keep opening doors.
So I guess the bottom line there is life is a discovery and things are going to change based on the opportunities you take. But if you never take any opportunities, you're never going to change.
Exactly.
One last thing I want to talk to you about, Joe.
Yep.
And that is, what skills do you think are important when it comes to finding your passions?
Wow. Well, the number one is courage to do what you're actually interested in. Josh Hodges' chapter in 18 and Lost is titled, What Are You Pretending to Care About? Which is his experience of going to uni, doing what he felt he should be doing rather than what he was actually interested in, which is sport. And his chapter, he talks about the cost of doing that, which was 7 years doing a 3-year degree because he wasn't passionate about it. So the ability to like listen to yourself and be self-aware is number one importance. In all the stuff I do with constant student education, I always start with self-awareness. You need to learn a lot about yourself, where your biases are and the patterns of behavior and thinking you have in your life, so you can actually monitor yourself. Then from that, I think networking, we're big on transferable skills, because transferable skills in the name says it, are skills you can apply to any situation, no matter what you do. So I know you're studying at uni, Jack, and you're also doing the podcast, and there could be anything you do in the future. But none of the things you're doing will you be disadvantaged by being proficient as a genuine networker, as a good public speaker, being able to write. I think 90% of my day is writing of some form, emails, books, blogs, copy on a website, whatever. Time management. No matter what you do, you're going to have to manage your time and be organized. There's a couple others. I think leadership, all that stuff about new discovery and open new doors, that's all leadership too, by the way. That's, I'm going to go here. This is where we need to go. And having the confidence to be the first person to go there. Yeah. So I think that transferable skills are very practical. We put a lot of emphasis on that now in Constant Student more than ever before, because no matter what situation, you're going to need those. And the foundational, because you need to listen to yourself to head in the first direction, right? To open that first door. The first skill fundamentally is being able to actually listen to yourself and go do that thing that you're actually interested in. Some people are lucky. When you want to be a lawyer, no one's really like these days going, that's not safe, don't do that. But for some people like me, it's film and some things that people think are not safe. I think there's nothing more dangerous than committing years of your life to doing something you're not interested in. So safe in what regard? So I think the first skill, Jack, I don't know, but has to be being able to listen to yourself and act on what you hear.
What advice would you give to people, Joe, about finding their passions?
If I were to wrap it up in one line, it would just be open doors. You're sitting in a room right now. Nothing's going to change in the room you're in. So if you do what you always did, you get what you always got. So if you don't feel it now, that passion, that elusive, how do you define it? Whatever passion feeling, if you don't feel it now, well, what's going to change if you don't change something? Something might change. It's better if you just take control. If it's not clear to people, you can do anything you want, pretty much. Most of you listening can do anything you want. So just go do it. Go open to something new.
Joe, I want to wrap up this podcast by opening a door to other people who are listening to this podcast. Where can they go to learn more about you and the work that you do?
Absolutely. I'd say probably one of the best places is my podcast, With Joe Wiebe Podcast. It's short, daily, bite-sized episodes, normally about practical learning, career, and philosophy stuff that you can apply when you're thinking about all these things. And then in there, I kind of talk about any other things we're doing, like Constant Student, if people want to go down that path and develop that kind of community around navigating the career and learning parts of life. And yeah, everything's probably streamlined through there. So With Joe Wiebe, wherever people get their podcasts, it's a good starting point.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for taking us on a journey about, you know, passions, and really was quite an insightful conversation. I know I certainly enjoyed it. So thank you very much for joining me on The Passion Effect, and all the best with everything you're doing right now.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for having me, and same to you.
What a story, what a person. But how can we actually apply the ideas from this week's episode to our own lives? Here are my three key takeaways from today's episode. Number one, open doors for others. As you heard from Joe's story, life is anything but linear. From university to not-for-profits to writing a book, as Joe says, the way you get anywhere in life is by opening doors for others, and others will open doors for you. Think about your own life. What doors and opportunities could you open up to someone else? Number two, audience of none. What would you do for an audience of none where the only applause you'd listen out for is your own? For Joe, the process of writing is something that brings him purpose and happiness. So ask yourself, what would you do for an audience of none? And then invest time into the thing that you love. Number three, learning through experiences. As Joe said, experience is probably the only real teacher in life. Joe's different experiences in life helped him understand where he does and where he doesn't want to invest his time. Keyword, invest. So I want to leave you with this question. What new experiences will you seek out, either in the next day, the next week, or even month? Then apply your learnings from that experience. Did I like it? Did I not like the experience? Why did I like it? Why did I not like it? So there you have it. Those are my three key takeaways from this episode. Let me know on Instagram what yours are. If you haven't already, make sure you're following The Passion Effect on Instagram at The Passion Effect Podcast and subscribe to the podcast on Spotify. Thank you so much all for joining us once again. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I'm your host, Jack Pittman, and until next time, keep following your passion.